It's my task to carry on in Luke's Gospel, and I think this is talk number three in Luke's Gospel. So we're going to look this morning at a very well-known, perhaps too well-known passage, and that's sometimes the problem with looking at things we've looked at since we were very young. But would you turn to 974, and Edward's going to come and read chapter 5, verses 1 to 11. So 974, chapter 5, verses 1 to 11.
It's under the heading, Jesus Calls His First Disciples. One day, as Jesus was standing by the lake of Gennesaret, the people were crowding around him and listening to the word of God. He saw, at the water's edge, two boats, left there by the fishermen who were washing their nets. He got into one of the boats, the one belonging to Simon, and asked him to put out a little way from the shore. Then he sat down and taught the people from the boat. When he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out into deep water and let the nets down for a catch." Simon answered, "Master, we worked hard all night and haven't caught anything, but because you say so, I'll let down the nets." When they had done so, they caught a large number of fish, that their nets began to break. So they signaled to their partners in the other boat to come and help them. And they came and filled both boats, so full that they began to sink. Then Simon Peter saw this. He fell at Jesus' knees and said, "Go away from me, Lord. I am a sinful man." For he and all his companions were astonished at the catch of the fish that they had taken. And so were James and John, sons of Zebedee, Simon's partners. Then Jesus said to Simon, "Don't be afraid. From now on, you will fish for people." So they pulled their boats up on the shore, left everything, and followed him.
Are there any Americans in the house? Yes, there are. It's election year in the United States, and I'm very excited. I can't wait. I love it. I love it. It's not till November, so my excitement is perhaps a bit premature. And although it doesn't concern us directly, or does it, there's a great sense of excitement and buzz about the election of a new president. So Mr. Obama has served his full 8 years. So it can't be him again. So there has to be a choice between a Republican and a Democrat, plus any independents who want to throw their Stetson into the ring. This is a party convention. It's a Snickers. Doesn't it? Won't appeal to anyone, everyone. Who's the guy on the platform accepting the nomination? Come on, Americans. You at least should know who that is. Who's that fellow? Oh, look. Who's there? Mitt Romney. Who said Mitt Romney? Well done. That's Mitt Romney accepting the nomination. So the party conventions will take place in the next few months, and the bands will play and the crowds will cheer, and hundreds of balloons will be released from the ceiling. But in the end, can you get rid of that one, Jane? In the end, it's all about the candidate. Yes, blank the screen, thanks. In the end, it's all about the candidate, the strong man or strong woman who aspires to be the leader. And if their media advisors are doing their job properly, they will be straining every muscle to make sure that their candidate is the most attractive. And one vital component of that is magnetism. the ability to draw someone to yourself. It goes a long way, love them or loathe them. And it was said of Bill Clinton, for example, that he had the knack of making the person he was talking to seem like the most important person in the room. He was a magnetic character. Now, I've got no doubt at all that when he was alive on earth, Jesus was a magnetic character. How else would you persuade people to stop in their tracks and listen to you preach? But he didn't stop people in their tracks just because he was a magnetic character. He had nothing to sell. He had no campaign to win. And although he was magnetic, he wasn't pushy. There must have been something else about him which drew people in. And this passage which Edwards just read to us is riveting for its strangeness. Imagine an equivalent, not a fishing, but an equivalent scene like that on Bethnal Green Road today or on Bishopsgate tomorrow. Jesus could stop crowds of people in their tracks through the power of his teaching. That's one thing, stopping people in their tracks through the power of his teaching. But what about the thing with the nets? Next photo. What about the thing with the nets? It's one thing to be a magnetic public preacher, but how do you persuade someone to throw out their nets again during the day after a fruitless night's fishing? Put out into deep water, he says. Let down the nets for a catch. Now, on the face of it, that's an outrageous thing to suggest. Could you criticize Simon if this had been his reaction? I am an experienced fisherman. I depend for my existence on my knowledge of fishing. And for the record, they weren't biting last night. And as far as I'm aware, you're a carpenter, not a fisherman. So why did Simon let down his nets? Well, let's think about that. It was said that the late, great David Bowie wrote the greatest love song lyrics ever when he wrote four simple words. Any takers? I can't quote the song, but I know the words. Anyone want to have a guess? No, I can't. I read this, I'm afraid, on the internet. I don't know what the song is. No, four little words. Close, four little words. Very close. I absolutely love you. Couldn't be simpler. And here, four little words with massive consequences. Because you say so. Because you say so, verse 5. He didn't consult with his partners and take a vote, because he had business partners, did Simon. He didn't say, can I think about it and get back to you? He didn't say, to be honest, that doesn't make any sense. He did it, quote, because you say so, unquote. So there must have been much more, I think, than magnetism to Jesus. Bill Clinton never possessed that power of command. And if you're a professional nighttime fisherman, you don't let your nets down in the daytime at the request of a carpenter unless there's something else going on. Now, it looks as if Simon had known Jesus for some time. This wasn't a walk-on scene where Jesus appears to Simon for the first time. If you go back to chapter 4, you'll see, for example, that Jesus healed Simon's mother-in-law, chapter 4, verse 39. So he had, if you like, spent time studying Jesus. But because you say so is a very clear sign that Simon knew at a very deep level that this was no mere man. Nor was Jesus just one of the magicians who were doing the rounds in first century Palestine at the time. And when the nets are bursting with fish, he doesn't applaud. He doesn't run to the next village to tell them what's happened to bring a bigger crowd. He doesn't say, "Can you do that again tomorrow, roughly this time?" What does he do? Verse 8. He falls at Jesus' knees and says these words, "Go away from me, Lord, I am a sinful man." So confronted with the real Jesus, Simon sees his sin, and really there is nothing he can say. But not because Jesus was an ogre, wanting to punish him or make him feel bad about himself, but because in the presence of Jesus, who was sinless, Simon saw his own sin. Can we just take a moment to look at this image here? The internet offered me 10 examples of paintings about this passage. A lot of them are too cheesy for words, but I thought this one was really moving. It's by a French artist called Tissot, and was probably painted around about 1890. And if you can get past the fact that Jesus is in an immaculate white cloak, I think it's actually very moving, because up in the top right-hand corner, on his knees, with his face buried in his hands, is Simon. Now, I can't tell you how long Simon spent on his knees. That would be speculation. Maybe just moments. But what strikes me right between the eyes is Simon's sense of awe. What's your best guess of what he's thinking? Perhaps nothing that you could really write down. Perhaps his mind, in a sense, is gloriously blank. Just a sense of his own sinfulness and his own need. And bear in mind this too. This image doesn't show it, but there were people watching. People watching the professional fisherman throwing out his nets at the request of a carpenter in the day, having had a fruitless night's fishing. People were watching Simon as he did that. Now, I contrast that with my half-hearted approach to Jesus. My preference, if you like, to pass him in the corridor. Do you know what I mean by that? Pass him in the corridor. Or at most, talk favorably about him if a situation arises. So perhaps the hidden gem in this passage, perhaps actually this far too, in a sense, well-known passage for us, is that it's a call to worship. In the purest sense of that word, we can find ourselves captivated by a song, by a view, by a nicely curled in free kick, by a painting, by a film. But how often am I captivated and driven to my knees by the power and perfection and sinlessness of Jesus? In our generation, I think we've lost the use of the word awe, but this hits the spot. And I think Simon saw Jesus for who he really is. It's like a moment of revelation. Of course, if he's not raised from the dead, as we believe him to be, then he is nothing. Our faith is junk. This church, any church, is just like a combination of a social club and a voluntary arm of the welfare state. But although Simon had only part of the picture, we have the whole picture. Simon didn't know at this point that Jesus would one day conquer death, and yet he threw himself at Jesus' knees. We have the whole picture. We've seen from beginning to end how the story unfolds. And so if he is raised from the dead, as we believe him to be, and if he does have the power to convict of sin and have authority to forgive sins, then that is the best news ever, is it not? or all other good news is just froth by comparison. And the scale and the scope of that, I suggest, should every so often drive us to our knees. So Simon may be an impulsive figure who didn't really care what people thought about him, but I could learn a lot from that. But then, it's time to get up and get going. Simon gets up and gets going. He doesn't stay on his knees. And I never tire of saying that likewise, we're a mission. Our primary purpose here is to make Jesus known in this area. How we do that will change from person to person, situation to situation. And back to our passage, Jesus describes that as being like fishers of men. Now that sounds rather cold and calculating. Fish are, after all, caught in order to be killed and eaten. Men and women, on the other hand, are to be saved and fed. The Bible tells us that the gathering of people is for rest, Matthew 11, joy, John 15, and eternal life, John 3. So who, according to this passage, is chosen for that task? Well, for one, Simon. Not because he was the keen kid at the front of the class who put his hand up and shouted, "Pick me, pick me," but because he did essentially as he was asked. Okay, he grumbled a bit. Who wouldn't? "Look, we've been out fishing half the night. We're tired." But he did it anyway. You don't have to score anything approaching 10 out of 10 to be valuable in God's plans, and if you did, none of us would qualify. So how do we leave these people at the end of this account? Well, we know that Simon became Peter. Peter went on to found the church. He proved his credentials. He could be trusted to obey. Put down your nets. No hesitation, really, just obedience. Now, there's an old-fashioned word, obedience. Doesn't obedience really end on our last day at school? Only perhaps if you've been on the Army or the Navy or the Air Force will you know about obedience, perhaps the hard way. And I value my children's half-hearted attempts to obey me. For example, by emptying the dishwasher when I ask them to. When they fight and they drop things and they put things away so that Pip and I can't find them for a week. The point is, as long as they're willing, basically, to do as I ask them, it counts for a lot. Especially on those rare occasions where they do it without having to be asked in the first place. And in the same way, I think Simon showed himself to be a good candidate for service because he was willing and obedient. Nothing really more complicated than that. And to repeat, he was the rock on which the church was built. So a willingness to obey led him to be entrusted with a massive task. And then I think the most startling thing of all, they declared, did these men, that they would leave everything and follow him. So they pulled their boats up on the shore, left everything and followed him. Now at the beginning I said this was a very familiar passage. Far too familiar, actually, for those of us who were brought up in church Sunday schools. The fishermen calmly lay down their nets, follow Jesus without so much as a backward glance. When I was a child, I remember thinking how neat and tidy that seemed. Nets placed neatly on the shore. They move off calmly, follow Jesus, and I'd go off and have my fish fingers and watch Magic Roundabout. It's so familiar that it completely fails to mesmerize us as it should. Yet the moment we bring it up to date and cast the fishermen in 21st century roles, it looks a ridiculous thing to have done. Just stick with the fisherman idea. You've bought a new fishing boat. The money seems at last to be coming in. Or your business is thriving. You've been able to take on more staff. Or you're a lawyer like me with more than enough interesting cases. Surely the idea of leaving everything is for other people, isn't it? I think the crunch question is this. What for me has become more valuable than following Christ? I don't have any nets to lay down. I don't have any employees to lay off. But I am the lawyer with lots of interesting cases, and it would be a massive wrench to leave them behind. Here's a story that I read this week from Nicky Gumbel, vicar at Holy Trinity Brompton. You might have seen this if you follow his daily blog. Raj was one of six children born into a wealthy Brahmin family. He was of the highest caste in the Indian caste system. At the age of 23, Raj encountered Jesus Christ. His family disinherited him. They cut him off. As far as they were concerned, he was dead. They even held a funeral service for him. Neither his parents nor his brothers or sisters have ever spoken to him since. For several weeks, he wandered the streets of Bangalore. He had virtually no food to eat. He walked all day and slept in the park at night. He started a new life. He began to speak about his new faith. And through him, thousands of other people encountered Jesus. He went on to lead a prayer movement of over 3 million. And now, over 40 years later, we are privileged that he's the national director of Alpha in India. He said to us recently that he has had a blessed life and that God had more than compensated for his losses. Although he left, quotes, everything, in Jesus Christ he found the pearl of great value. So let's be blunt. To think of ourselves as fishers of men sounds old-fashioned, out of date, and embarrassing. I don't have to go too far back in the memory bank to fish out, if you'll pardon the expression, a Sunday school song which went, "I will make you fishers of men." There you go. Please don't ask me to sing it. Simon, perhaps afterwards? Not. But if we can get beyond that, if we can get beyond that, and recall that we're sitting here today because we were once helped to understand not just who Jesus was, but who he is, then being called fishers of men sounds a lot more urgent. If who Jesus is drives us to our knees in awe, then that same awe, sense of awe and wonder, will get us off our knees and being fishers of men. So a question for you as we come to the end. If we want to reach out to people and in that way be fishers of men, can we only do it if we're prepared to leave behind what we're doing now? Putting down our nets, if you like. Is there a Premier League for fishers of men based on the distance you're prepared to change from what you know? Being blunt, the Bible can appear to pose that question sometimes and create a sense of guilt or second-class citizenship unless it's understood properly. So let me give you a homegrown example. I've given a tip-off to Mike. Meg wasn't around at the time, but this is a homegrown example about the very wonderful Jonathan Mitchell, son of Mike and Meg, who runs his own company called Brothers We Stand. Many of you will know his clothing brand. Brothers We Stand is basically an ethical menswear brand, only selling clothes which have been made in factories which uphold the highest ethical standards for their employees and always using sustainable materials. And last week, Jonathan was interviewed for an online magazine called Dot Magazine. This is he in his orange puffer jacket, preparing for a very classy Shoreditch-based photo shoot. Some of you will have seen this on Facebook and some of you shared it. Now, I don't know how big the circulation of Dot Magazine is, D-O-T-T, Dot Magazine, but it looks achingly cool in a Shoreditch sort of way. So I'm guessing that most of its readers will be in their 20s. Those are the days. Anyway, of the readership of Dot Magazine, who knows? Most, I suspect, unchurched. So the interview, and I don't believe it to be a Christian magazine. I think it's a Shoreditch thing. Jonathan was asked by the person who interviewed him what drove him to do what he was doing. And so here's the interviewer's question and Jonathan's answer. Question first. Throughout the interview, I've been trying to understand the mindset of an entrepreneur like Jonathan. But it becomes clear when I make the mistake of suggesting Jonathan is brave. But no, it's not bravery for Jonathan, it's God. Jonathan says this, "I walk step by step." Now, this is a secular online magazine for the hipster crowd, right? That's the context of this answer. "I walk step by step with God. I trust in him that he will show me what he wants me to do. That's an amazing thing to know. It frees me up. I don't have fear, and I can go for it. My inspiration is the possibility of making change. I use my gifts to do what I can. I don't know what will happen, but I'm excited to see what might be. So there we are, a seriously credible statement right in the middle of a magazine aimed not at Christians, as far as I know, but at young people with a similar entrepreneurial business mindset to Jonathan's. And it takes courage to say that sort of thing, especially in a hostile world. And so that's exactly, I think, what being fishers of men is usually all about. Communicating God's love from exactly where we are. If you read this account from Luke, it might seem as if at any moment we're going to be called to drop everything and walk off in a completely different direction. For some, that will be the case. For others, probably for most, it's right to stay exactly where we are, like Jonathan has, in a sense. But I think the one certainty is this. Jonathan has, at one time or another, himself fallen to his knees and declared, "Go away from me, Lord, I'm a sinful man." And at the same time has understood the breadth and height and depth of God's love for him. Putting it another way, he's passing on what he himself has first received. That's all it is. Amen.